training, and it was a job training program, something like that?
Yeah, well, it was a job training and government make-work job creation program.
That's what. Okay, yeah, so you could create jobs through this program, and then different politicians would say, look at how many jobs I brought to my district through this CETA.
That's it, CETA, yep. CETA was famous for boosting employment, but they just... they were much more effective at making jobs and at getting people to work. But that's typical for government job creation. It's an absolute boondoggle. It was a squandering of vast amount of resources. They were so proud of the dumb things which they did to create jobs, such as out in Oregon, I think that they built an artificial rock for rock climbers to practice on. They were going door to door to sign up people for food stamps. There were a lot of other programs, and what they did in many places simply boost the number of employees on local government payrolls. But there was a study which came out a few years after the program was replaced by some other federal boondoggle, and the study found that people that enrolled in CETA had lower subsequent earnings than people who were never on the government payroll. And this is part of the same pattern that's continued since then, that you have all these government job programs and all these politicians boasting about the good they're doing, but overall it has a net, it harms the lives of the trainees.
I remember a passage in one of my favorite books by Thomas Sowell, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality, when he points out that a typical civil rights leader will point to 100 jobs that were brought to his area by CETA, but the fact is, if you got rid of occupational licensing in a particular area or you abolished the taxi medallion system in New York, you would do vastly more for, let's say, black employment than you could possibly do with your 100 miserable jobs. But those jobs are earmarked. They're public. We can see that the cause of them was the government. And it's a feather in the civil rights leader's cap. But it's no feather in his cap to do something that's of just general benefit to the downtrodden. And particularly because it won't be immediately obvious what the consequences are, because it's part of the so-called unseen effects of repealing a government program. So this sort of program grows despite its total lack of effectiveness. It's like the Job Corps. The Job Corps' effectiveness is practically nil. Very, very few people who go through it wind up getting a job in that field. They generally have wages that are no higher than people who didn't go through the program at all, didn't show up for the program. And yet these things go on. I once naively, back in my academic days, I had a student naively ask me, well, if this program doesn't work, why does it still exist? Why does a program still exist, Jim Bovard, if it doesn't work?
Well, it's a question of how you define doesn't work, because...
Yeah,
okay,
work for whom?
Yeah, well, you know, these job training programs have not worked out well for the trainees, but they've been great for the politicians. They've been great for a lot of the contractors who run their programs, who make donations to politicians, or the government social service agencies, which get a vast number of new people on the dole from these programs. It's interesting. The summer job programs, which started in the Great Society, are still going on in some places. This is a wonderful example of what happens when the government decides to give people, teenagers, a step up in the world. What happens instead is that the government often ruins people's work ethic. And this was pointed out almost 50 years ago by the General Accounting Office, which said the summer jobs cause youth to get a false notion of what can be of what people get wages for, because in D.C. they just show up and they get a paycheck. I did an investigation for Reader's Digest on this in the late 1980s. I was going around looking at some of the programs, and my favorite summer jobs program was something called the Marion Barry Youth Leadership Institute. And it was named after the mayor.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, named after the mayor. And at this point, the mayor had only had about 38 different corruption scandals linked to him. He was never convicted for corruption. He was convicted for other things. But, you know, just an utterly tainted son-of-a-gun weasel. And since he's dead, he can't sue me for libel. But the folks at Labor Department, the U.S. Labor Department, bankrolled this Marion Barry Youth Leadership Institute, which was also very, very, very clearly linked to some of the stuff that Barry's reelection campaign did. And it's like, it was bizarre that, and I went there and they just had all these kids sitting around in groups just kind of shooting the bull. And I think a big topic of that day was whether or not girls enjoyed sex. And I'm thinking, okay, what kind of jobs are they training them for?
Unbelievable. You know, by the way, before we go on, there's one other program that might seem trivial to my listeners, but it matters to me because as I was growing up and becoming politically aware, I mean, I first really got interested in politics, let's say, around age 12. And then by age 16, I was very interested in it. So age 16 was the 1988 election, and H.W. Bush, yeah, he had chosen Dan Quayle as his running mate. Now, you, as a specialist in labor policy, will know where this is going. I distinctly remember Dan Quayle, this undistinguished senator from Indiana, pointing to the Job Training Partnership Act as one of his great legislative achievements, and he was so happy that he'd been able to reach across the aisle and collaborate with Ted Kennedy on this. And, of course, that should have made you think, this can't possibly be any good. When did Ted Kennedy do anything for the free market? But he touted this and touted this, so it was like a blast from the past reading your book to come across the Job Training Partnership Act. I never read anything about it at the time as to whether it was any good. I just assumed it was a boondoggle, but it turns out it really wasn't so good.
Well, that's putting it mildly. Yeah, I had some fun with that. A number of folks from the Labor Department had very vehement attacks on my writing on this, but there was a story which I did shortly after Quayle was nominated for vice president. I did the piece for the New Republic, a piece called Quayle's Egg, which looked at the record of this Job Training Partnership Act in Quayle's own state of Indiana, showing it was basically a bunch of welfare for corporations and government agencies. The folks on Capitol Hill were upset by that article. Somebody asked the inspector general to investigate my allegations. The IG report came back and confirmed almost everything I'd said, though it did quibble with the exact cost of a few outlays. Now, and so after that, the Reader's Digest wanted me to do an investigation. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Labor Department. They basically told me to, you know, take a long walk on a short pier in spite of the law, which says that they have to be, give this information out. So, and I was the folks at Labor Department at the Employment and Training Administration, I knew that they hated me because I'd written about them many times, and they were just, you know, I just had the sense that they were biased against me. And so when I did, Reader's Digest wanted me to interview the Secretary of Labor, Elizabeth Dole. So instead of going through the Employment Training Office, I just called her office directly, and, you know, there was some funny back and forth, and they first said, yeah, okay, sure, come on and interview her. And then they said, well, maybe we'll just do it by phone. And so I said, well, you know, if we do it by phone, Mrs. Dole's picture might not get in the article of Reader's Digest. So they said, well, okay, come on in. And it was a funny experience. Me and the managing editor of Reader's Digest, Bill Schultz, went there to interview her. And she'd been in politics for more than 20 years at that point. And she was all dolled up, and she greeted us like we were visiting the throne of a small European kingdom. The interview was set for 30 minutes. So she starts talking nonstop. And she literally talked for about 16 minutes without breathing. And it occurred to me that, you know, it's going to be impossible to get any information because she was just doing her talking points. So, and finally, I just jumped in and sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but okay, for instance, there was this boondoggle program out in California. Why did JTBA finance that? And she just stops and stares. And then the Digest editor asked a question, and then she and I started going back. He and I started doing a back and forth series of questions, and she didn't know anything about the program except the talking points. So after about 10 minutes of this, she finally said, well, you know, I think you want to talk to the employment and training branch. So, you know, and so she kind of kicked us out of the office. And as soon as we got out of her secretarial suite, her press secretary had been interviewed. She had been sitting next to me, and I was kind of concerned because her knees were shaking, literally, and I was afraid she was going to pass out. But as soon as we got out in the hallway, it was funny because this woman just started screaming and shouting, I can't believe you did that. Like we'd violated the secretary's dignity. But my favorite part of the story is I found out a year afterwards that just after we'd left, the press secretary called over to the employment training branch and said, okay, there's a problem here. The Secretary Dole was just interviewed by someone who asked a lot of difficult questions. And so the people there said, well, who was it? And they said, well, this Bovard guy. They said, you let him speak to the secretary? Are you nuts? So anyhow.
That's a compliment. That is a real compliment.
Well, I was, you know, folks out there would have loved to see me skinned. So, and I had a lot of back and forth with them. And it's funny, once the Reader's Digest article came out, the folks in the secretary's office made a huge push to try and destroy the credibility. They were leaking documents and sending around these memos. But, you know, the program was a boondoggle, and eventually even Congress admitted that.
Before I let you go, there's so many things in this book, by the way, Public Policy Hooligan. You guys would love reading it. And by the way, it's great summer reading because not only do you learn a lot, but of course, with Jim Bovard writing it, the prose just sparkles, the stories jump off the page. It's not just a book about public policy. It's a book about this particular person uncovering all these horrifying episodes. So it's very, very interesting to read. There's one other item I want to make mention of. It's from your discussion of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, just the stuff, and I know this is controversial, but that's why I'm bringing it up, just the stuff about Section 8 rental subsidies. Now, this doesn't sound like any big deal. Okay, rental subsidies, who cares? But this turns out to be a big, big problem. You wrote a 9,000-word American Spectator article about it. There was a spinoff from it that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. What exactly was this? I've got this quotation from that at that time, the HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros, saying that America is a society divided spatially, which is, as you note in your book, is a strange way of putting things. What does that mean? We don't all live in the same house? Obviously, yeah. We're divided spatially. But then he says his fair housing czar, I believe there was such a thing, Roberta Aktenberg, said to NPR, "We are compelled by statutory prescription as well as constitutional mandate to see to it that every American has open and free housing choice." Well, okay, I mean, I guess they're all free market people because that's what we're all about, is open and free housing choice. But it turns out this is not really a free market program, Jim Bovard. I'm disappointed once again. What does it turn out to be?
Well, it's you know, it's a typical liberal democratic thing in which some people get free choice with other people's paychecks. The Section 8 gives rental subsidies, what they call now housing choice vouchers. And it's for a very small selected group of people to get favored with these basically these government entitlement to live quite well and not have to work, because studies have shown that the receiving Section 8 decreases people's work levels. I think that the subsidies now are up to $2,500 or $3,000 a month in some places for free rent. And there is a mindset which is bred by this, because Section 8 is not an entitlement program, which means that not everybody who is a low income is receives it, but the local housing agencies get to pick and choose. The city of Baltimore had an opening up for its waiting list for Section 8 last October, and take a guess how many people tried to sign up for Section 8 in Baltimore.
Oh, I'd love to know the figure.
Almost a third of the households in the entire city.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yes. And that's on top of almost 10% of the households in Baltimore who are already getting housing welfare. So, but Section 8 is seen as Section 8 is like winning the lottery for folks who are looking to have a more comfortable lifestyle without working. And it's had a profoundly corruptive impact in a lot of ways. There were lots of protests in Baltimore by even a Democratic senator who said that what was happening with Section 8 was being given to people in public housing projects and so that they could move elsewhere. And the Democratic senator said there that what HUD may be doing is simply, it's getting rid of vertical ghettos and creating horizontal ghettos, because there's been a great deal of crime associated with Section 8. There were studies that show that the homicide rate goes up when Section 8, their residents move in. There was a HUD-funded study which found that kids which found that young boys in Section 8 families that move to certain places are far more likely to commit crimes, especially property crimes. It's been a fiasco at many different levels.
Well, the really controversial aspect of it is that, of course, you're accused of racism, naturally, accused of racism for existing, but for being opposed to this program, because what you're really saying is you don't want to have black neighbors. Because part of this your article was called Clinton's Wrecking Ball for the Suburbs. And the idea was that we're going to take these people, we're going to spread people who are recipients of Section 8 rental subsidies, we're going to spread them out all over the place. And I've got this quotation here. Cisneros said that the Chicago families, referring to people in this Chicago program that gave these people Section 8 vouchers, the Chicago families have been good neighbors and have been accepted by these communities. But you go on to say, but Section 8 merely redistributed murder from public housing projects to new neighborhoods, according to an analysis published the following decade in the academic journal Homicide Studies. HUD's expatriates soon became notorious for violence across the Midwest. Well, no one's allowed to point that out, but that might help to account for why people were not in favor of this program. It's not that they're against free and open housing choice. If somebody can pay for his house, welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah, and Section 8 has been linked to crime for decades. I did a story, I guess, about in late May for USA Today on the role of HUD, public housing, and Section 8 in helping pave the way to the Baltimore riots, because HUD has had a huge impact in Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, and they have created these areas of impunity, crime with impunity. There was a HUD study in the, I think, 1979, which admitted that in one large public housing project in Baltimore, that the crime rate was 20 times the national average, 20 times. And there's a huge spillover effect. So you had to have a project, and it would end up dragging down the neighborhoods around it. And what HUD would do is they might bulldoze one project, but then they give Section 8 vouchers. Folks would move to other neighborhoods, and sometimes those neighborhoods would be dragged down. A huge part of the trouble is that HUD is not willing to use sound management over the people who get the government subsidies. So you don't have the normal incentive that a property owner would have to be very careful that his property is being maintained.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Public Policy Hooligan, Rollicking and Wrangling from Helltown to Washington. We're going to link to it on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/436. And, of course, you can go directly to Amazon to get it, but tomwoods.com/436 will have links related to this particular episode. It is always your trusty companion to each of the episodes of this show. Well, Jim, it's been great chatting. Of course, we're just scratching the surface of what's in this book, but as I say, always leave them wanting more, right? Leave them wanting to go out and get their copy for fantastic summer reading of Public Policy Hooligan. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom.
All right, everybody. Check out James Bovard at jimbovard.com. Of course, we're linking to that on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/436. Tomorrow, we turn our attention to the Republican nomination process. We're going to talk about Rand Paul and foreign policy with Brian Daugherty of Reason Magazine, the author of a very interesting article on just that subject. Remember also to sign up for my unobtrusive and even helpful weekly letter, and also get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, by texting the word LIBERTY to 33444. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free.